Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're wading into one of the murkiest, most financially fraught scenarios facing modern banking. And it's this disputed payment that, well, that wasn't technically unauthorized. I want you to picture a scene that fincrime teams are dealing with, I mean, probably every single hour. A customer logs into their banking app, they successfully pass multiple security checks, and they actively instruct a pretty significant transfer of funds, an authorized push payment or APP.
Right.
The money leaves the bank, it hits a third-party account. But then, just moments later, that same customer calls back, totally distraught, claiming they were the victim of a really sophisticated scam.
Mm-hmm. They claim they were coerced, often by someone pretending to be from the bank itself, you know, tricking them into hitting that final send button. And this is the financial services industry's ultimate Gordian knot. It really is. These disputed cases sit in this incredibly precarious gray area.
A gray area.
Yeah. We're trying to figure out the line between genuine, devastating social engineering, where a vulnerable customer is just completely manipulated, and, on the other hand, deliberate customer misconduct, or even abuse.
Where the customer is fabricating or, you know, exaggerating a claim just to shift that financial liability back to the bank.
Exactly.
And that distinction, the true victim versus the, let's say, strategic claimant, that's the core challenge. So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack the growing complexity of these claims.
Yeah.
We need to explore the operational pressures this puts on fincrime and compliance teams, the systemic risks the banks are absorbing, and most critically, the specific behavioral and transactional red flags that investigators use to try and separate fact from fiction. Okay, let's unpack this. We should probably start with the underlying mechanism. Technically, what we're talking about here is an authorized push payment or APP.
Right. And that is the hard definition because the customer themselves, you know, they initiated the transfer, they successfully passed all the security controls.
So from an infrastructure perspective, the system worked perfectly.
Exactly. The bank fulfilled its security duty. But then, as soon as that money is gone, the customer starts what you could call a narrative reframing.
A reframing.
They assert they were victims of external manipulation or coercion or deception. The story is almost always the same. A sophisticated phone-based scammer, often impersonating a government agency, a police officer, or, and this is the crucial one, the customer's own bank.
Compelling them to move their money to a so-called safe account.
Precisely.
So the scammer uses urgency and fear to override the customer's rational judgment. But here's the question for me. If the customer retained control, if they are the ones physically keying in the final password or hitting the final authorization button, how is that not automatically the customer's sole responsibility?
And that's the operational friction point. The source material highlights that while genuine, sophisticated social engineering is very, very real, fincrime departments are increasingly identifying claims where the scam narrative is. Well, it's exaggerated, or sometimes outright fabricated.
And this fabrication has a clear purpose.
It absolutely does. It's done strategically to trigger reimbursement processes.
Uh-huh.
The customer has learned that if they successfully frame the incident as a scam or coercion, they increase their chances that liability shifts to the bank under modern consumer protection guidelines. They are, in essence, filing an insurance claim based on an altered version of events.
Okay, so if the customer is claiming coercion, but the bank suspects deliberate abuse. Mm-hmm. What are the key indicators? What raises that initial suspicion?
There are a couple of immediate transactional flags. First is that retention of control. Despite claims of the fraudster, you know, remotely accessing their account, the hard logs show the customer retained physical control of their device. They successfully completed multi-factor authentication steps themselves.
The data doesn't lie.
The data doesn't lie. Second, the beneficiary account details. If investigators find that the account receiving the funds shows signs of prior linkage or familiarity.
But you're implying that sometimes the customer actually knows the person receiving the money?
We're implying that the transaction isn't entirely at arm's length. Or in some cases, that the customer might be operating as part of a deeper criminal network. And thirdly, there's the timing. If the complaint is filed immediately, but strategically, say, within the exact window that triggers a regulatory requirement for fast reimbursement, it suggests the customer is manipulating the protection framework, not genuinely panicking.
Wow. Understanding how customers try to exploit the system, it really gives you a chilling view of the high financial stakes involved here. Let's turn now to the key risk dimensions this abuse creates for the banks themselves. Because it's far more than just losing the value of that one transaction, isn't it?
Oh, it's so much more. But let's start with the most tangible one, which is just the financial loss risk.
Right. The actual cash.
Exactly. When a bank reimburses a customer for a transaction they technically authorized, especially once that money has moved internationally or, you know, into crypto exchanges, that loss is often completely unrecoverable.
So the bank is just eating the cost of an irreversible customer-initiated payment.
They're eating the cost. And this leads directly to the next one, the regulatory and compliance risk, and specifically the abuse of consumer protection frameworks.
Okay, so this is where it gets deep. Policies that were designed to safeguard vulnerable customers are now being exploited.
This is the operational vulnerability. When regulatory regimes impose a high standard of liability on the bank, it creates this massive incentive for opportunistic customers to game the system.
Right.
If the standards for reimbursement are applied inconsistently or just too broadly, the framework becomes this unintentional subsidy for criminal behavior. The bank has to walk this fine line of protecting customers without becoming an easy target for abuse, and that's a compliance nightmare.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture of organized crime, we're moving into AML and collusion risk. This is where a simple case of a customer lying to get their money back evolves into something much more serious.
That's right. Because a percentage of these disputed claims are not simple self-inflicted losses. They show really clear indicators of collusion. The customer might be working with or even acting as a money mule.
Funneling funds from their own account into a criminal ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. And this raises profound anti-money laundering concerns because now the bank isn't just losing money. They're being used as a critical step in a chain of organized crime. We're talking about facilitating the movement of illicit funds.
And then finally, we have the reputational and conduct risk, which, I mean, this is perhaps the most difficult one to manage. It's a genuine tightrope walk.
It is, because banks face reputational damage and regulatory fines for two contradictory actions. First, for incorrectly denying a reimbursement to a legitimate, highly vulnerable victim, which makes the bank look, you know, uncaring.
Yeah.
And second, for routinely reimbursing claims that are fundamentally abusive, which makes the bank look incompetent and just encourages more exploitation. Their reputation is severely damaged if their investigative process is seen as either ruthless or reckless.
So given these high stakes, fincrime teams have to rely on a pretty specific investigative toolkit, right? Aggregating multiple indicators, the red flags, to increase suspicion of abuse or collusion.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's dig into those specifics. What are the key indicators investigators are looking for in the timeline of the transaction?
Transaction timing is crucial. Investigators look for evidence of rapid, almost mechanical execution. A critical red flag is the extremely short time frame between the customer funding the transfer, say, moving a large sum from a locked savings account, and then immediately executing the outbound payment.
Because that suggests pre-planning, which contradicts a story of, you know, spontaneous panic coercion.
Exactly. Additionally, the timing of the escalation matters. If the customer waits until the precise moment the funds clear the account before immediately escalating the claim, often citing the full regulatory title for it, it strongly suggests they were waiting for the money to be irretrievable before starting the process to get it back from the bank.
That's fascinating. What about the technical security controls that are supposed to protect everyone? Where does strong customer authentication fit in?
Strong customer authentication, or SCA. It's mentioned constantly in the source material because it's the bank's key defense, right? It requires two or more elements, something you know, something you have, or something you are.
Sure.
Critically, if the bank's logs show that the customer successfully completed SCA without any security anomaly, it strongly suggests that the system was not compromised. The customer willingly and knowingly provided the final authenticators.
That successful completion, it must dramatically shift the burden of proof onto the customer to prove they were coerced.
It does. It really does.
And what about the final destination of the money? What does the nature of the beneficiary account tell them?
The destination is critical for spotting collusion. Investigators flag beneficiaries located in high-risk jurisdictions or accounts linked to previously unseen mule typologies.
And a typology is just a recognized pattern of criminal behavior.
Yeah, exactly. When we talk about new mule typologies, we mean new methods criminals use to quickly set up temporary destination accounts. They're often exploiting newly opened accounts, or maybe accounts opened by vulnerable people, just to move the stolen funds before the bank can freeze them.
So the bank is using transaction data to try and map the criminal network, even if the customer claims they were dealing with some isolated scammer.
Exactly. They connect the dots. And beyond the transaction itself, fincrime teams look for behavioral inconsistencies in the customer's claim narrative. This is often where the entire case is won or lost.
Can you give us an example of a specific inconsistency? I mean, why would a genuine victim hide details?
Well, a genuine victim is often stressed, confused, highly emotional, but they usually want to provide every single detail they can remember to help catch the perpetrator.
Right.
Conversely, an investigator might find the customer's description of the alleged scam call, the specific demands, the tone, the sense of urgency, is strangely vague, or it's inconsistent when they're cross-examined. More importantly, they resist providing crucial, hard details, the exact phone number the fraudster used, the precise timeline of the conversation, or access to their call logs.
And that resistance is the key.
That resistance significantly increases suspicion. The psychological insight here is that when a claimant resists providing basic call data, it suggests they're either trying to hide a known link to the beneficiary or the specific narrative they're using to trigger reimbursement. It just doesn't align with the hard data on their device.
That is a powerful insight.
Yeah.
But we have to reinforce the crucial caveat here, which the sources stress repeatedly. No single factor is determinative. You can't judge a case on a single red flag.
Absolutely not. The investigation is entirely based on the aggregation of these signals. A customer transferring money quickly might just be an efficient customer. But a customer transferring money quickly, using a new mule typology account, and then resisting providing call logs while citing a precise regulatory term for reimbursement, that aggregation is what pushes the case from probable victim into high suspicion of abuse.
So this whole landscape, it demands avoiding what the sources call binary thinking.
Yeah. These cases rarely fall cleanly into simple fraud or simple customer fault. They often exist on a spectrum of customer behavior, from extreme negligence all the way to deliberate collusion. This requires incredibly nuanced judgment.
So what does a structured, evidence-led approach look like for a bank that wants to handle these complex cases effectively, fairly, and, you know, in a way that's regulatorily defensible?
Best practices demand a 360-degree view. That starts with correlating all the available data. Transaction data has to be seamlessly matched up with authentication logs, device IDs, and geolocation data.
They need to know if the device used for the transfer was located where the customer claimed to be.
And if the device ID matches their known historical profile.
Exactly. And it sounds like you also have to overlay the customer's long-term history, not just this one transaction.
Precisely. Investigators must assess the behavioral consistency of the claim against the customer's historical profile. Has this customer initiated massive push payments before? Are these Sutter high-value transfers completely out of character? If the claim is for a life-altering amount of money, the bank needs to confirm the narrative aligns with the customer's established pattern of life.
Okay.
And crucially, they have to apply a clear operational distinction between technical authorization, the fact the customer hit send, and psychological coercion. The investigation has to actively seek external evidence of that coercion. Things like third-party reports, call recordings, any communication between the customer and the alleged scammer.
And if they can't find credible, supporting evidence of that duress,
then the finding defaults back to the technical authorization.
And the final critical step is accountability and clarity.
Yes. For every single decision reimburse or deny, the bank must meticulously document the decision rationales. This ensures auditability and regulatory defensibility. They have to be able to show a regulator step by step why they concluded it was genuine coercion or high negligence or deliberate abuse.
So ultimately, navigating this demands mature investigative frameworks, and it sounds like a huge amount of collaboration.
It does. This can't be siloed. The fraud desk provides the transactional timeline, AML provides the mule typology mapping, legal gives the regulatory interpretation, and customer protection provides the behavioral context. It requires integration across all these functions to build that full picture.
So what does this all mean? The main takeaway for me is that disputed transfers after customer authorized payments,
right,
they're one of the most complex, high-risk challenges in modern fraud operations. It's because of this unavoidable overlap. It's a Venn diagram where genuine victimization, customer negligence, and deliberate abuse all intersect.
And what's actively driving this complexity, as the sources note, are two accelerating trends. First, scam narratives are becoming exponentially more sophisticated, constantly evolving to bypass existing controls. And second, customer awareness of reimbursement mechanisms is increasing, making the abuse of these protection frameworks a more attractive strategy.
So banks have to just continually refine their detection, their investigation, and their adjudication capabilities to maintain that balance between fairness, managing financial risk, and meeting those high regulatory expectations.
That's the challenge.
Okay, here's a final provocative thought for you to mull over. Our deep dive has highlighted that customer awareness of these reimbursement mechanisms, well, it increases the risk of exploitation. Yeah. We've seen this happen across multiple industries where policies intended to help the vulnerable are weaponized by the opportunistic.
So, when policies designed to protect genuine victims of social engineering become so widely known, how do institutions prevent that very protection framework? The rules intended to provide a safety net from fundamentally becoming the new, highly profitable target for both customers and organized crime. That's the tension facing the financial industry right now.